This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
I'm happy to welcome you to another scintillating episode of Clusterfucked. I'm your personable host, Roger King. I'm looking forward to today's guest. As much as I like talking to liberals on the ground in red states, who are some of our frequent guests, some of my favorite episodes are when we talk to people on the other side of the aisle. And today's guest is one of the most high-profile never-Trump conservatives in the country. He was a longtime Republican consultant and strategist. He specialized in attack ads that helped to defeat many of our beloved Democrats, can you imagine? But he never dreamt in a million years his party would nominate, let alone elect, Donald Trump. And now he's spends a good chunk of his time through his regular column at the Daily Beast, through many appearances you've probably seen on CNN and other networks, as a frequent panelist on Bill Maher's Real Time on HBO. He spends his time making the case that Donald Trump is unfit for office and cheering on his defeat in 2020. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Everything Trump Touches Dies, and he's just released a new book, which I'm sure will also go on to be a bestseller, entitled Running Against the Devil: A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves. His Twitter feed alone provides hours of entertainment. It's my pleasure to welcome Rick Wilson to Clusterfuck. Rick, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So off the top, just to give listeners a sense of how you feel about this president, I thought I'd begin by reading what could be my favorite tweet of yours of all time. About a year ago, Trump tweeted, "No president ever worked harder than me cleaning up the mess I inherited." And you responded, "You are a gravid wretch presently cable-flipping news and pity-tweeting. During the day, you'll expend more energy doing your exotic lemur fur wig than governing. You'll end your day shoving a brace of Filet-O-Fish extra sauce down your lie hole and watching six more hours of TV." I mean, it's not Chaucer or Yeats, but I think it gets the job done.
You know, I try to get right to the point.
Okay, so I want to get to the new book. And, you know, given this is a podcast about what Democrats should do to win more elections, you know, I want to talk about your advice, of course. But I just wanted to start with your former party. Do you even consider yourself a Republican anymore?
No, I mean, there's no Republican Party anymore. There's no what party would that be at this point? It's all Donald Trump all the time.
Understood. Well, so where I'm going with this is that, you know, I don't think Mitch McConnell and the establishment Republicans expected Trump to win. They thought they were going to be in opposition to a Hillary Clinton presidency.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And when he did win, they shifted to, transactional relationship where they can, you know, he's putting on his clown show and is a great distraction while they can get the conservative judges confirmed and the tax cuts and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And what my question is, I mean, you know these guys, they're all in now, of course. It's 3 years later. They got to ride the rapids with him.
Sure.
The base isn't going anywhere. So where do you think they think it's going to go long-term with the party? Is their plan that, hey, when Trump's gone, we'll get back to normal? Is that what you think they actually hope and expect to happen? And what do you think's going to happen if he loses in November?
Yeah, there are two threads. One thread is the belief that we are at the apocalypse, that Trump's that the downside, the backlash on this is going to be so extraordinary that we may be in the wilderness for a very long time. So because of that, we better get while the getting is good. Harvest everything you can, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will lose our elections. So that's one half of the sense that's out there. The other is slightly more optimistic, but vastly less realistic, and that's from the Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz camp, and they believe that we're in this nationalist populist moment, and that the future is nationalism, and the future is populism without all the rough edges of Donald Trump. This is a foolish and fallacious belief, of course, and the idea that they can turn Trumpism into something that isn't based on racial animus, ethnic hostility, cruelty, and general human shittiness is, of course, an idiotic play.
Right, and
these guys, the base of Trump, and they were always a part of the Republican Party, but not the old mainstream of it. There's a part of the Trump base that loves the cruelty, that loves the shitty human beings around Trump, that loves his like terrible transgressive nature, that gets them off in a way that nothing else in politics ever has.
Right, as long as he's going after the liberals, that's great, whatever he says and does.
Right, as long as we're owning the libs, we can burn down the Constitution. Yay.
Well, you know, it's hard to imagine that part of the base just returning to, you know, normal cheering on establishment
That's
Republicans.
That's right. That's right. They're not ever going back. And look, he also proved something, and it was, and you know, I've certainly admitted this quite a few times. He proved something that guys like me were wrong. The base never gave a shit about balanced budgets or fiscal discipline or the Constitution. They wanted a show. They wanted a circus. They wanted entertainment. They didn't want a fair and balanced news media. They wanted their own pet silo that would tell them and validate what everything they believed. And they got it.
Absolutely. And has this been, you know, because I think it's gutsy for you and the Never Trump conservatives to, you know, have been so critical of the party. And I appreciate your candor and you know, taking a risk, because it would have been easy to sort of cash in on Trumpism. And,
oh, God.
You know, I imagine you've probably lost some friends, certainly some clients and colleagues and that sort of thing.
Oh, well, yeah, well, look, I say this, you know, there's an interesting accusation that comes at me from the left very often. It's like, you're just here to cash in on the big bucks. I'm like, listen, I had a number one New York Times bestseller, and I don't get paid to go on TV, but I've had a number one New York Times bestseller, and the money I made off of that is rounding error for what I would have made off of one political race in a cycle.
Right.
And so this idea that this is, I mean, look, this is, if I was smart about it, I would have shut my mouth, never said a damn thing, you know, and I could have gotten away with what a lot of my former colleagues do, which is they're not Trumpers. They don't believe in any of his silly, you know, ridiculous MAGA-isms, but they keep their mouth shut and they get their jobs and they get their work from the RNC and the other committees. And they still make their money, you know, do their thing. If I had been, you know, amoral, I maybe should have done that. But I could not bring myself at this point, because I know that these things iterate beyond just a Trump-like character. They become worse, and worse things come from them. And I had this sense that we were on this moment, this precipice in this country, where if he gets away with this, and he's enabled and empowered to get away with it by the GOP, there will be a consequence for the country down the line that is very, very dark. So I'm willing to take my licks from, you know, losing friends and losing clients and losing relationships from over the years, because I know in the end I'm doing the right thing, and I know in the end that you know, the worst case scenario, you know, is not QAnon ships me off to Gitmo. The worst case scenario is we slide into this terrible new authoritarianism that is, you know, even if Republicans now sort of deny that and say, oh, that would never be me, I'd never go for that, they're demonstrating every day they would indeed go for that.
Oh, yeah, we see how it happens, how it plays out.
And in many other times and places, it's just this same pattern. It starts out with the bad press and the lying press and those evil immigrants coming here to take your job and all those things. We've seen this iterate over time, and it never works out. So I'm not going to be a party to it.
Well, and again, I appreciate that. And I've seen liberals, not just what you were saying earlier, you know, criticize you and others, you know, or they say, you know, you're doing it for a buck or whatever. But they also say, hey, you know, we appreciate you don't like Trump any more than we do, but don't give us advice. You know, we don't want to hear. And of course, I'm the opposite. I think that you have valuable insight to offer us, which brings us to the book that has just come out. And I had a chance to read it and I loved it.
Thank you.
It's roughly divided into two parts. In the first half, you go over all the things that you were sort of alluding to just now that are likely to happen in a second Trump term, as a clear warning to all Democrats, you know, and really all decent Americans about the stakes in this election, and, you know, with the obvious inference to keep our eyes on the prize here. You know, he must be defeated.
Correct.
And then the second half is a blueprint of do's and don'ts for Democrats and how to beat Trump. And it's not, you know, about specific Democratic candidates as much as a general strategy. But I wanted to, one of the key points you make, and I was thinking about it a little bit before I read the book, and now I'm thinking about it, you know, much more. You drum home the point that any president running for re-election, it's a referendum on that president.
Yes.
Or it should be. Yeah, it's, do you want another 4 years of this guy? And you don't, you don't spend a lot of time talking about specific candidates in the book. You take a few shots at Bernie, but, you know, obviously I think partially is that because you probably wrote it last fall and it's released this year and you didn't want to spend your time talking about candidates who would no longer be in the race.
Right.
But, you know, the point being that if the Democrats nominate a Biden or someone moderate, the chances are the discussion will be a referendum on Trump. Do we want another 4 years of this guy? But if you nominate a Bernie, then the risk is it allows Trump and the Republicans to change the conversation and to say, hey, he's promising all these major changes to American life. Do you want this revolution?
Here comes the communism.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so that was kind of, would you say that's the general theme you were trying to drum home, among other things, in the book?
You know, one of the things I try to do in this book is not to say, here's the nominee you should pick. I'm not trying to pick the Democratic candidate. I'm not trying to tell the Democrats, you know, alter your policy this way or that. I'm really not. What I am telling them is, you know, if you do pick a Bernie and I were still doing what I used to do, I would do the biggest victory dance you've ever seen. I would be in heaven. Bernie is a guy who, first off, he's not a Democrat, as we all know.
Right.
Second off, he has, you know, a track record of dividing the Democratic Party very meaningfully in 2016. I don't think he's got the shot that his people think. And I jokingly say this, the guy will lose 44 or 45 states. It'll be the worst defeat since Mondale.
I've heard you say that, yes.
For a lot of reasons. And again, it's not just that I think Bernie is like basically communist version of Rand Paul, but he is 97 years old or whatever the hell he is. He is unbelievably easy to turn into a caricature for, you know, and believe me, my guys are really good at that. Really, really good at that. And I think it ends up not where Bernie, you know, and the progressive side want it to be, but where Trump wants it to be. And I will say this, I've spoken with an awful lot of Democrats, including some fairly senior people in the last couple of weeks. And Bernie is not well liked in the party, even among some folks who you would consider fairly progressive.
Right.
And because I think they smell defeat on him.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess the devil's advocate pushback you hear from those who support him and other progressives is that, you know, any time in recent history, either party has, you know, selected a more establishment sort of safe choice. It hasn't worked out. You know, Al Gore, John Kerry, Mitt Romney, John McCain. Obviously, Hillary Clinton would be in that category. So, what do you answer to that when they say, "Look, hey, when we do the safe choice, we lose"?
Well, I think you can make the case that Barack Obama, at the end of the day, was an eminently safe choice because he had talent. Mm-hmm. He had charisma. He had skill. You can make the argument that the last three Republican presidential elections, where the Republicans won, were actually all fairly safe choices. So, Bernie is not a conventional liberal or a conventional progressive. Bernie is Jeremy Corbyn, and, you know, the British Labour Party right now is wondering. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was an existential mistake for them in a lot of ways. They are now, it would be the equivalent of the Democrats losing places like Washington State and Oregon. You know, holding California and New York, but losing Massachusetts is the degree of the blowout Corbyn caused the Labour Party.
Right.
If you have a Bernie scenario where you lose or you are unable to gain the Senate, which, you know, it's a tough road no matter what, but it's doable, and you lose some of your House majority and maybe even lose your House majority, good luck with the purity test.
Yes, exactly. Well, I, you know, one of the arguments that you hear is, you know, Bernie excites the, you know, the youth, the young voters, and, you know, there's this constant talk about excitement. You mentioned Obama, of course. You know, he's a once-in-a-generation candidate that people were legitimately excited about. But, you know, I'm not sure any of these candidates are going to generate, you know, anywhere near that kind of excitement. But on the youth vote, there was a little part of your book which I found really interesting. You have a quote from a data analyst who you asked for some numbers on youth votes. Mm-hmm. And the response was essentially, you know, he gave you a bunch of data, but then he said, let me sum it up. The electoral college states in play are mostly, and I quote, old as fuck.
Yeah.
If your models assume young voter magic, you're going to have a bad day.
Yeah.
Now, I think there was an increase in youth turnout a bit in 2018, the midterms. But can you speak to where the youth vote is at?
There was an increase in the 18 midterms. But, you know, people forget that the peak youth voter turnout in the last 50 years, the peak youth voter turnout was for those two young, exciting, energetic candidates, George Herbert Walker Bush and Mike Dukakis. 18.1% youth voter turnout that year. And it sort of defies the stereotype of you know, do you need a young Obama style candidate to do it? And honestly, you know, what we know is that you really don't. The other part of that is, again, in the Electoral College model, and when my friend gave me that data, we had been sort of talking about that for a little while. We know who votes in the big swing state of Florida. Old people. Not just old people.
Right.
Really old people. And, you know, your fives of fives, as we say in the voter, in the way we talk about voters, we score them 1 through 5. If you're a 5 of 5, you vote in every election. You vote for the off-year dog catcher special election. You vote in everything. Fives of fives in Florida, on average, are around 80 years old. It's insanity.
Right.
I mean, they're old. They're old, old, old. And this idea that you're going to magically whip up enough young voters in states that are old demographically is – you know, it's a waste of effort, and it's a waste of warm bodies and money and investment and political capital. And, you know, the difficulty they have is this idea of appealing to young voters ends up with things like, you know, the free college and all the other things that cause older voters across the political spectrum to go, wait a minute, not just Republican older voters. So, you know, and I hate raining on the parade, but it's not, there are no shortcuts in this work. There are no easy, like, freebies in this game. It is going to be hard. It is going to be challenging. It's going to cause a lot of you've got to be very politically disciplined about it. There are no free passes in this, and nobody gets to indulge themselves in whatever ideological fantasies that light them up as a rule.
Well, and you spend a good chunk of the back half of the book not just telling Democrats what you think how they should you know, approach this election, but also, of course, going over the campaign that Trump is likely to run.
Sure.
Spoiler alert: scorched earth. You know, I think it's interesting because I imagine as a former consultant strategist, you know, it was amazing when an opposing candidate had one ethical issue or one personal failing or
right.
One thing. And here you've got Trump with just 1,000 things you could go at. It's like some high-end buffet in Las Vegas. It's like, where do you start? And on that note, as a strategist, where would you advise to go after him? You can't pick everything.
No.
There's so much to choose from. How do you narrow it down?
Look, I think the two things you're going for, and remember, we're talking about swing states. We're talking about a game of small numbers. We're looking for the independent and leaning Democrat men and independent and leaning Republican women in the swing states that we've discussed ad infinitum.
Right.
And one of the big messages that works with those folks is corruption. And one thing Donald Trump excels at is being the most corrupt president of our lifetimes by a long stretch,
right?
Including Nixon by a long stretch. So getting on the corruption message is vital. The cruelty message is vital. That also works very powerfully with those groups. And so it's important that we not lose sight of the ability we've got to go and hammer those people on the Trump side with that message. It's also hard, you know, it's hard for them to walk away from that, because there are ways you can debate whether Trump's approach to, you know, regulation or energy or healthcare or climate or any other anything. You can debate those things, and people could say, oh, he's, you know, that's a three-dimensional chess game, or he really wants to do this or that. But you can't debate the corruption thing. It's either black or white. And there are a lot of folks that have made excuses for Trump. And if you start giving them a moment where they have to face their decision and face the way they've supported him, even knowing those things, you know, it's harder to say, I know him, I know exactly what I'm getting now, and I'm still going to support him, versus what they said in 16, which was, well, he can't be as bad as Hillary, so I'm going to support him.
Well, and you mentioned, for example, the kids in the cages, you know, down at the border, and an obvious target where you can hammer him on that. And again, that keeps the narrative on him versus proposing a whole bunch of game-changing policies that allow him to switch the narrative over to, well, I know maybe you don't like me that much, but...
Right. Well, aren't you afraid of communist Sharia law?
Can the two of those go together, I wonder?
You know, in his head, they can and do.
Well, and you mentioned swing states. Let's just drill down a little bit for a second. In your book, you list a maximum of 15 states that are going to be in play. So we all know 35 are pretty much already decided one way or the other. And I just wanted to talk about a couple of them. Starting with your home state of Florida, which I know you know, inside and out. I loved your line about Floridians loving low taxes, a clean environment, and their love of guns is rivaled only by the tribes of northwestern Pakistan.
Your story.
That's right up there with this other line I heard about Florida. Somebody said it on Twitter. I don't know who it was. It wasn't anyone very well known, but he said, if Floridians were voting on having free ice cream or a kick in the head, it would still be 50-49.
Yes, that is correct.
So what's going on in Florida? How can the Democrats wrestle this state back from Trump?
Well, I think the number one assignment Democrats have in Florida is to jack Hispanic and African-American turnout through the roof. They have gotten a great gift that Hillary Clinton's campaign pulled their Potemkin Village Act with in terms of Puerto Rican voters, and they were not able to motivate and activate them. They had a chance to take 250,000, 300,000 new voters in the state who are inclined to vote Democratic, and they blew it. They did not go out and actually do the work of contacting, registering, and advocating to those people and turning them out. That's target A in the great state of Florida. Target B is African-American turnout, which lagged very badly, even more so than the national average in 2016. And they need to get African-American turnout back on track. Third thing is they need to not scare the hell out of the suburban ring voters in the counties surrounding the Tampa Bay area and the Orlando area. Those two areas are the swingiest of the swing parts of Florida. And in those areas, you know, you're going to have a lot of women voters who are not Trump inclined, but they also heard the phrase Medicare for all takes away your private health insurance. And whether it's true or false, it is now a part of the Republican mythology, and they believe it.
Right.
So you got to address that quickly. You got to put that behind the Democratic nominee very quickly, or there's going to be a problem.
Right.
Final thing in Florida is everything north of I-4, with some small exceptions in Leon County, where Tallahassee is, and a few other small places north of I-4, the way that Republicans have beaten Democrats there, the way we took the Democratic Party apart to the point where in the last 15 years, they went from a majority of the seats of the state legislative seats and the county elected seats to almost none, to almost zero, was gun control. Because in that part of the state, male Democrats are voting Republican based on almost that one issue alone. You don't get anything extra out of Miami or Broward, Dade, and Palm Beach counties by advocating for the things like semi-automatic weapons bans, as Andrew Gillum did, but you do lose everything north of I-4. And it's a, you know, and it, again, I say this not as a policy thing or advocating a policy question. I just know what works in the state of Florida.
Right. And in the short term.
I know that as much as Shannon Watts thinks that gun control is the secret sauce of everything, it's not.
You know, and I was just going to say, you know, in terms of Democrats are making progress in persuading people, but it's, you know, that may, that's not the fight to have right now if you want to get Trump out. It's
right.
You know, it's short term. Be cautious. Let's zip quickly to the Rust Belt, my home state of Michigan,
sure.
Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Everyone knows those are the three states Trump narrowly won, flipped them. That gave him the election. His approval rating in all three states is underwater. So we're not talking about huge popularity there. And the Democrats did pretty well in all three states in the 2018 midterms. What's your assessment of where things are and to win those three states? That would be the ballgame right there.
It would be the ballgame. I think that Wisconsin and Michigan are both open questions right now. There's a very good opportunity in both those states. I think that unfortunately for the Democrats, Ohio may be slipping away. Just from some polling I've seen. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One of the reasons is Catholic Democrats are not, they don't hate Donald Trump, and they tend to be slightly more pro-life than the average Democrat, but it's just enough in this game of small numbers to cause a fairly high degree of disruption. So, you know, I think that the Democrats need to put a lot of juice into Wisconsin and Michigan. They also need to focus in the Sun Belt on Arizona, which could have some very good outcomes if they play their cards right.
That's actually the last two states I was going to touch on, two red states, given on this podcast we talk about how Democrats can win more in the red states. Arizona and Georgia are thought to be, and they were on your list of, you know, potential pickups, particularly Arizona. As you say, they already flipped the Senate seat in 2018. John McCain's seat is up in 2020. They have a good shot there, too. But talk a little bit about Arizona and Georgia as potential Democratic pickups against Trump.
Yeah, Georgia is very difficult. But it's not impossible. Again, in Georgia, once again, the gun control question outside of the 20 plus counties that are the donut around Atlanta, you know, gun control is a game changer. It is a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. Now, if you get to the point where you're competitive outside those areas, you know, Georgia, you take Georgia out of the equation for Trump, and it's a very, very, very different election.
Right.
It's an extraordinarily different election.
Are there progressive policies that would not play well in those two states? Getting back to that theme of
Georgia traditionally has been fairly pro-life. But it's not a pure wash anymore. You know, it's not pro-choice Atlanta, pro-life Georgia. It's sort of fought to a draw. Georgia is a state very strongly driven by two big cultural divides, and they're not black and white. They're not, you know, liberal conservative. They're urban and rural.
Right.
And so, you know, everybody outside of Atlanta views Atlanta now as sort of the blue capital, totally disconnected from their lives every day. The rest of Georgia's economy has been sort of Atlanta's has been explosive.
Right.
So, you know, I think communicating with the suburban families around Atlanta is a very strong, up note for Democrats if they can get it done.
Right. And we saw suburban voters repelled by Trump in the midterms. And that's generally thought of as where Democrats can really make up some ground.
It is. It is for sure. And, you know, there's no secret sauce here. You've got to go out every day and register voters. You've got to go out every day and hustle to convince those voters that you register that getting out to vote is absolutely vital. You can't, the only easy day was yesterday, and the only easy job is somebody else's. Everything you got to do in this race is going to be very tough, and the work has to be put in based on metrics and accountability and not your preferences or ideological fantasies or what you'd like to do. It's what you must do.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, I mentioned it in the book, you know, as we talked about earlier, you don't go into that many specifics about the Democratic candidates, but I thought we could just finish off with a quick lightning round here. And I'll name a candidate. You, as a strategist, tell me one thing about that candidate that you think is a strength, or, you know, hey, you know, we'd have a little trouble with this running against them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the conversely, one thing that's a weakness that you would love to run against them
for
this reason.
Sure, so sure.
I'll just, you know, no particular order. Andrew Yang, the businessman tech guy, is still in the race raising money. Running against him.
Super smart, super interesting guy. Also weird. And weird doesn't sell.
Fair enough. Let's lump the billionaires together, even though they're a little different. Tom Steyer and Michael Bloomberg. Who would have thought there'd still be two billionaires left in the Democratic primaries? But we're doing this interview a couple weeks before the Iowa caucuses. There they are running against those two.
Wildly out of touch billionaire liberals trying to buy the election. It's not a great flavor for either party right now, honestly. Mm-hmm. Nobody loves that.
Right.
Now, in both of their cases, they're also ideologically mismatched. Bloomberg has a slight up note in the whole businessman taking care of, you know, the hard details thing, but I don't think it's sufficient to overcome the downside of being the sole funder practically of the nation's gun control movement.
Back to the gun control again. Yeah. I thought when, you know, Bloomberg got in the race so late, I thought if he just jumped in and said, look, I'm a real billionaire, I'm going to take on the fake billionaire.
Right.
That probably would have gotten him more traction than anything. Okay, moving along, Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota.
She's still a little rough around the edges as a candidate, but on the upside, if the Democrats don't put her on the ticket somewhere, I think they're out of their damn minds. I think she's got a certain level of she connects. She's got a certain level of Midwestern modesty and friendliness. She doesn't come across as an ideological zealot. You know, she's perfectly progressive, but she doesn't come across as hectoring or lecturing. I think she's got a terrific future ahead of her, honestly.
Right, and which is reflected in the fact that she wins counties in Minnesota that are red, you know,
right.
And that's her argument. Look, I've done it.
Yep.
Okay, and then contrast that, Liz Warren.
On the plus side, Liz Warren is very smart. She's very considerate about her, you know, wanting to be the smartest person in the room and wanting to have a, you know, a plan for everything. On the downside, she has a plan for everything, and plans don't win elections. Plans lose elections. Plans lose elections a lot.
That was a point you emphasized in the book.
I did make that point. I think I tried to beat that point in pretty heavily in the book, which is,
yes.
You come to me with a bunch of plans and policies. I'm going to put some nerds to work on those plans and policies, and I'm going to find ways to scare the hell out of moderate voters with those plans and policies. And Democrats, you know, said to me, oh, I can't believe that plans, policies sell all the time, to which I always counter. Barack Obama's policy fit on a poster. He didn't run based on a 300-page, you know, healthcare plan or a 80-page transportation plan or what have you.
Yeah.
It was very much, you know, the feel of Barack Obama, the look, the sense of who he was. They weren't trying to sell you on the fact that he was a policy genius. They were trying to sell you on the fact that he was a great charismatic leader to replace George Bush.
Right, and a lot of these key swing states really hinge on low-info voters, and again, they're not looking for policy papers.
Uh-uh, they are definitely not. In fact, that often has a blowback effect with those folks.
Yeah, if it's too much. Let's finish with the killer bees, starting with Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Young, talented, I like him. I don't know if his problem with African-American voters is fixable. And he doesn't seem to be having a breakthrough with them. And if you can't have that breakthrough, you can't win the nomination. Can't win the nomination, you're not in the ball game. So you look at the guy and you know he's got a brain, you know he's got talent, and it's just like he's almost there as a truly great candidate, but he isn't quite connected yet.
Well, perfect segue to when you speak of African American voters, Joe Biden.
Joe Biden is the strongest candidate in the race on one hand, because name ID in politics is magic. Mm-hmm. And name ID is legitimately the single determinative factor in re-elections. But I think there's also the downside that Joe Biden, you know, has foot and mouth disease. Mm-hmm. And you may end up with people who sort of, you know, have some qualms about that. Now, I do think he bothers Trump tremendously, which is a delight.
Right.
Trump really dislikes Joe Biden. And he's gone after him for a reason, because he's terrified of this guy who has a populist side of him that Trump worries could be weaponized against him. And he's not wrong. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, can Joe Biden beat Donald Trump? I think he can. Will it be easy? No, because Joe Biden's Joe Biden. He's gonna say stupid shit periodically, and people are gonna go, oh God. But you know, one thing about, I was in a focus group about Biden about a year ago, and somebody said, you know, he's not evil, which kind of shocked me, because I'm thinking, so that's our standard now. Not evil. Okay.
Well, and I can't remember the last time someone who says stupid things all the time was elected.
Yeah, right. How'd that happen?
Yeah. And we'll finish with Bernie Sanders, a strength and a weakness.
A strength of Bernie Sanders is he does have a passionate cadre of supporters who would set themselves on fire for him. Mm-hmm. The downside of Bernie Sanders is he's a billion years old. He just had a heart attack. He's every caricature that the Republicans could pray for. He's not a Democrat. He's already divided the party once. There's deep bad blood for Bernie inside the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And because of all these things combining, there's a possibility that Bernie ends up, you know, all those things are offset in the general. He's way too far to the left for most of America. And I don't mean that as, you know, saying that liberals can't win. I say that Bernie's version of it is way too far to the left. I mean, we're just short of like March the Aristos to the guillotine level with Bernie. And that is a bit, probably a bridge too far.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think progressives, a number of them convince themselves that not that, hey, you know, I have good ideas and we've got to go out and persuade more voters. They're convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that voters are already persuaded, that they're crying out for all these progressive policies. And the only thing standing in the way is some entity, you know, corporations or crooked politicians or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what I always say. Look, I think people need to be persuaded more rather than assuming that they already are.
There's a lot more persuasion that needs to be done before the workers' paradise is upon us.
Listen, Rick, I appreciate you taking the time. The new book is Running Against the Devil, A Plot to Save America from Trump and Democrats from Themselves. As I said off the top, I like hearing from you and other Never Trump conservatives. You've beaten Democrats before. You understand how what it takes to win an election. So I appreciate your insight. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
And that was Rick Wilson, entertaining as I expected it would be, and insightful, I think. Rick has a website, therickwilson.com, or therickwilson.com, I guess. You can go there and read his articles and obviously pick up either the best-selling book that we mentioned, the New York Times bestseller, Everything Trump Touches Dies, or the new book, Running Against the Devil. And he's on Twitter, of course. As I mentioned, his Twitter feed is very entertaining when he gets going on a thread about Trump in particular. Twitter feed is @TheRickWilson or @TheRickWilson. Hey, when you're on Twitter, if you're following Rick, you might as well follow me too. I'm the Civil Liberal, but my handle is @CFThePodcast. And we're on Facebook as well. Just search for CF the Podcast. You can find us, like the page. We post the episodes, of course, but other things, articles pertaining to what Democrats are doing in red states and all that good stuff. This podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and all the fine platforms that you normally go to for your favorite podcasts. We, of course, love it when you come to the website, cfthepodcast.com. The episodes are there, as well as other information about the program and anything else we might be doing. One day I'd love to do a live taping of an episode, so you can stay informed that way by joining our mailing list when you go to the website, cfthepodcast.com. And if you want to support the podcast, you can do that too. It's a labor of love. I don't have any big advertiser or investor. I'm doing this out of the goodness of my heart. But we have expenses. We record at the very fine recording studio, dbaudio.ca. We have website and audio hosting and other marketing costs. So if you're feeling generous, we appreciate it. Visit cfthepodcast.com. But if it's more convenient for you to listen on iTunes, subscribe there or Stitcher or Spotify, please do. The important thing is that you listen. And I do appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
The Clusterfuck Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
This is Roger King. That'll be all.